It's Lars Larson. Thanks for listening to my podcast and for listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get back to your phone call shortly at 866-HEY-LARS. But I want to talk about a cyber stalking law in the state of Washington, which makes it illegal for you to effectively say mean things about someone. Now, I'll differentiate between things you say that are threatening, like I'm going to beat you up, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to hurt you or your family, and things that are just critical of someone else. Apparently, there are some in law enforcement and maybe even in the DA's offices who believe that you can prosecute someone for merely saying things that are critical of someone else. There's a case just like that involving Richard Lee Reinerson, who has now filed a lawsuit against the Washington Attorney General Bob Ferguson and the Kitsap County Prosecutor Tina Robinson, filed suit in U.S. Circuit District Court on Tuesday. And one of the lawyers who's going to bat for Mr. Reinerson is an old friend of the program, and that is Professor Eugene Volokh, the law professor at UCLA School of Law. Professor Volokh, good to have you on the program.
Oh, good to be on.
Listen, tell me this. Why do you... Well, let me have you react, first of all, to the idea that there is a cyber-stalking law that makes it illegal to say mean things, critical things, but not threatening things about people. Can that possibly be constitutional?
No, it can't. That's my view as a lawyer here, but it's also something I've long argued as an academic. Washington statute in particular bans online speech that's said repeatedly or anonymously. If a jury finds that the speaker's purpose is to, quote, harass, intimidate, torment, or embarrass. So if you say something twice online with the intent to embarrass someone, could be a government official, could be a law professor, could be anybody else, then you're committing a crime. Likewise, if you are intending to torment, there's no definition of torment, but presumably it's if you're intending to say things that make the other person feel bad, or intending to harass. Harass itself is not well defined, but basically, if you look at how it's been defined elsewhere, the dictionary definition, for example, says to vex, trouble, or annoy continually or chronically. So if somebody posts things that repeatedly annoy and are intended to annoy their subject, again, could be a government official or could be a local activist. That's a crime. That cannot be correct. I think it's clearly unconstitutional. But there it is. It's in the Washington statutes.
I'm talking to Eugene Volokh, who's a law professor. He also publishes the blog The Volokh Conspiracy and is the author of several textbooks, most recently The First Amendment and Related Statutes. Professor, I have a confession for you, because it sounds as though I do this on a daily basis. I mean, I go on the air, and our radio show is broadcast on radio stations, but it's also carried online. So online, I regularly and routinely say things that I'm sure would be vexing to Hillary Clinton, Nancy Pelosi, various governors and right. senators and everything else. Effectively, this cyber-stalking law makes it illegal for me to do what I do every day.
That's right. All I should say, it is the law is limited to speech that is intended to embarrass.
Well, I intend to embarrass politicians on a regular basis.
There you go. And I think some people deserve to be embarrassed. Journalists do that all the time. By the way, I'm also challenging, also pro bono, but with a different set of lawyers and different clients, an Ohio law that actually is a little different from the Washington law. One of the ways is it has a specific exclusion for the media. So you and I would probably be immune for things we post online in our publications, but ordinary people who aren't employed by a newspaper or a radio station or a list of other such media, well, nope. They don't get the special privilege of being able to speak about people with the intent to supposedly harass them.
Professor, I find that one offensive because I've always pointed out to people, as a journalist, I don't have any more rights or fewer rights than a general member of the public. I mean, I have a microphone, but I right. don't have any extra rights.
You shouldn't have extra rights, generally speaking, and the First Amendment does not give you any extra rights. But Ohio law, again, Washington doesn't fall into this problem, but Ohio law does decide that well, you know, journalists should be free to intend to harass people, but not ordinary folk.
So this gentleman we're talking about, Richard Lee Reinerson III, is a man who's been critical of a local activist, a man who founded a memorial to the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, Clarence Moriwaki. And as I understand the controversy, Mr. Reinerson has been critical of Mr. Moriwaki because he says if you're going to object to the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, you should also object to indefinite detention of people in the war on terror in 2017. And I don't necessarily agree with him on the indefinite detention, but I agree with his ability to go out and criticize Mr. Moriwaki. And yet he's been threatened with prosecution. Do I understand that correctly?
Yes, that's exactly right. And the prosecutor actually so the police department referred that to the prosecutor, and I believe the police department's view was there was probable cause for the prosecution. A prosecutor decided that he wouldn't prosecute at this point, but said that, well, we might prosecute you if you keep doing this sort of thing. So that shows that there really is a serious threat of prosecution for our particular client, which is which will help our case go forward procedurally. We're arguing the statute is unconstitutional on its face. So it doesn't just our lawsuit doesn't just focus on the particular thing that Mr. Reinerson said, but in order to have standing to challenge the law, it helps that he has in fact been specifically threatened with prosecution.
I mean, the thing about this is this is such a routine thing to do that if you take issue with a local city council member, a county commissioner, or a governor or a state representative, if I wanted to be critical of Richard Blumenthal, I'd regularly remind people that he lied about serving in Vietnam, and he did lie about serving in Vietnam. Now it might be that Blumenthal is pushing, you know, keeping Obamacare or whatever, but one of the techniques you might use is to say, remember, this guy who's promising you in this bill that he's going to do good for you is the same guy who lied to you about Vietnam. If I do that on a regular basis, of course I intend to vex him, and of course I intend to embarrass him, but I'm allowed to do that, right?
Right. Indeed. Well, let me give you an example of how else a nearby provision of the same statute was used a few years ago. In the city of Renton in Washington, this is back in 2011, there were some sex scandals, minor sex scandals in the police department. And somebody started posting YouTube videos, little cartoon videos, which were referring to these sex scandals. There's a nearby provision of the statute which applies not to repeated communications, but to any lewd, lascivious, or indecent or obscene words, images, or languages. Language or suggesting the commission of any lewd or lascivious act with the intent to harass, intimidate, torment, or embarrass. So what happened is the city got a search warrant in order to review records to try to figure out who it was who was posting these things on the theory that these criticisms of the police department were lewd and lascivious.
Boy, talk about a chilling effect.
Right. So some of the time, the government may even realize, look, you know, maybe the prosecution won't come to anything. But we can maybe identify the person, we can out them, we can settle them with legal bills. And that's the problem with having these kinds of overbroad laws on the statute books, and we're hoping that it's going to get struck down.
Is the state of Washington going to defend this law? Ferguson must realize that this thing has real First Amendment problems.
Well, I should hope so, but, you know, I've seen state officials defend laws like this. I will say that their job is, in large measure, to defend what the legislature has enacted. The Washington legislature did enact this. Now, I do think they're entitled to it. I think the right thing to do is if a law is clearly unconstitutional, then they should acknowledge that. And it's also the best way to save state resources. But, you know, I can imagine them saying, look, you know, we're going to try to defend it as best we can because we're lawyers for the state and we want to defend the legislature's handiwork. I wouldn't fault them for that, but I do think it would be a mistake.
Well, I do think this cyber-stalking law is facially unconstitutional. Professor Volek, it's always a pleasure to have you come on the program. Thank you so very much.
Very much my pleasure. All the best.
Thank you. Law professor from UCLA School of Law. He publishes The Volek Conspiracy, and he's the author most recently of The First Amendment and Related Statutes. He is Professor Eugene Volek, and this is the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to get your phone calls and your emails on a Conspiracy Theory Thursday. We had a great time speaking with Cheryl Atkison last night. Her brand new book called The Smear, fantastic. Don't forget, First Amendment Friday is celebrated every week on this program so that naysayers and others like them can get a chance to sound off. We've got a number of things on the agenda today, including a lot of feedback on the idea that the Oregon legislature very quickly went out and decriminalized heroin. So that means you can expect heroin use to go up in the months ahead here in the state of Oregon, and probably some of it will make its way across the border into Washington state as well. Patrick writes in, Lars, these people who are for legalizing heroin so you can function with it on a job are full of it. I'm an ex-heroin addict, and you can't function on it because you nod off. I just couldn't imagine the forklift driver on heroin nodding off and perhaps running over his boss. And about that cyber-stalking law, Gary writes in, Lars, would that mean that all the media in Washington owes Donald Trump and his family billions of dollars in damages? Well, maybe prosecution in Washington stay if they ever get the chance. But does anybody out there want a law to stay that says that if you get on social media and you merely say things that are critical or embarrassing or troubling or vexing, but not threatening, that you can be prosecuted by the local prosecutor if you live in Washington state? Let's go to Ed. Hey, Ed, welcome to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. You're a hard guy to get a hold of.
You think so? Actually, it's pretty easy. I got lots of emails. I got lots of phone numbers, and you can call me 6 hours of the day. So I don't know how much more available I can be.
I've called you 3 times. The first time I've been able to talk to you.
Well, I appreciate it. What's on your mind?
So, first, about the decriminalizing heroin, I just want to say I think that is dangerously stupid, but I want to play the devil's advocate for a minute.
Go for it. I do that every once in a while.
What's my disincentive for going out burning my alfalfa field today and planting poppies in it and starting to grow poppies and producing opium and then refining it and, you know, making my own heroin?
I guess the first disincentive is you'd lose a lot of money. The DEQ would be all over you. They'd write fines to beat the band. And then the crop you'd grow, at least now, would still be illegal. So they've decriminalized the possession and use, but they have not decriminalized sale. So you can't sell heroin. You can't buy heroin. But if you happen to have it and you get caught with it, you can no longer be convicted or even threatened with a felony.
So if I have 10 pounds of heroin in my barn.
I think that above a use quantity, they're going to go after you as a dealer. If it's simple possession, which is, and there, the incentive, as I understand it from the prosecutors, if they catch somebody with a small use quantity of heroin, they want to get the person into treatment. I can remember when a judge named Harl Haas pioneered a thing called drug court, and there were others involved in that as well, and I don't want to give all the credit to him, but he's one of the names that comes up. Josh Marquis is a big fan of drug court, where they say to you, would you like to get off the stuff? If you do, and you're willing to take treatment, and you can keep it up for a period of time, we will excuse the felony. Now, that would seem to me to be a powerful incentive to get into treatment and try and beat the drug.
Absolutely.
And now that is gone, thanks to Kate Brown and the Democrats in Salem.
So what I'm seeing is the handwriting on the wall.
Oh, and John and Jim Huffman as well. So.
And by that, I mean the people that are making the most money in the marijuana trade right now are the people that already had the infrastructure built up when that became legal.
Yeah.
So it was all the people that were trafficked in the black market that had their grow operations set up. Bam, they legalized it. Those guys are the only ones that are making the big bucks. So, the next step for this, if it follows along the marijuana lines, is they're going to legalize it.
Well, perhaps, but, in that, you heard the lady I had on, the former prosecutor, who says, yeah, she'd like to see all three of the major hard drugs, meth, cocaine, and heroin, legalized. I think long before that happens, I think you're going to see practical evidence that this move was a bad move. I think you're going to see more overdoses. I think you're going to see more people addicted. You're going to see more trafficking, because imagine what the drug dealers are thinking right now. They're obviously making money, even if they're selling the stuff at you know, $30 a day per addict. If all of a sudden the legal enforcement of possession goes down dramatically, and the disincentive to stay on drugs goes down dramatically, then they'll realize Oregon's a place we can sell a whole lot more of this drug.
And they'll be raking it in.
They will be raking it in. And then you'll hear the argument, well, we should just legalize it. Well, I love to, when people call in as naysayers and say, we should legalize it. And I say, tell me a job that you could imagine you could work safely if you're a drug addict. And if the answer is, and they don't have an answer, I'll say, well, how about the daycare where your kids or your nieces and nephews are taken care of? And they'll say, oh, no, not daycares. Oh, well, how about the bank where you bank your money? Well, no. I mean, do you want an Uber driver who likes to shoot up now and then?
No, I think drug addiction is the job. I mean, that's their chosen profession for the rest of their life.
Well, and if, you know, I can imagine someone, Ed, who began drinking a beer now and then or a glass of wine now and then. We know there are tens of millions of Americans who do that. They have a drink now and then. They don't seek to get drunk. Do you know anybody who shoots heroin and says, oh, I don't actually want to get high. I'm just shooting enough because I like to stick the needle in my arm, or I like the feel of that stuff going in. You know, I mean, there are people. The other day I was out working outside and it was hot. And when I got done working and I put the tools away, I popped a beer and I drank one beer. I got zero buzz from that beer. I wasn't seeking to get drunk or even get a little buzz going. I just wanted a cold beer on a hot day. Now, there's nobody who uses cocaine that way. There's nobody who uses methamphetamine that way just because they like the aroma and taste of methamphetamine smoke. Going into their lungs. And I mean, I've never shot heroin and don't ever plan to shoot heroin, but I'm trying to imagine the guy who's got a needle in his arms and one of his fellow addicts says, so are you going to get high or are you just shooting a little bit for the feel? You know, and because beer and wine can be consumed that way. Heroin and coke cannot.
Agreed. There's actually a joke along those lines that said, I never liked cocaine. I just liked the way it smelled.
While you've still got a nose, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Ed, thank you very much. I appreciate the call. 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Our quick poll, is it constitutional to ban mean speech on social media as cyber stalking? Washington State has just such a law. It's being challenged on constitutional grounds. And will Washington Attorney General Bob Ferguson defend this clearly unconstitutional law? You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to get your phone calls and your emails, and there's so much on the agenda today. First of all, I want to hear one person who believes that this cyber stalking law in Washington State is legal or sensible. A law that literally says you can't criticize anyone. Not your next door neighbor, not the person who gave you bad service at some retail outlet, not a politician, not a city council member. You can't criticize anyone. And if you decide that it has become your mission in life to embarrass someone that you have some beef with, that's constitutional free speech. And if you want to do it anonymously, you remember Ben Franklin wrote some famous anonymous letters that were published by his brother's newspaper. His brother didn't even know he was doing it. Did he have a right to do that? Absolutely, he had a right to do that. So let's see if Bob Ferguson decides to defend this nonsense. Anyway, to your calls, naysayer Benjamin's on the line from Bellingham. Hey, Benjamin, welcome to the program. Thanks for listening on KVI. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. I was just curious about this debate about the decriminalization of heroin and other hard drugs in Oregon.
Well, only heroin for starters. They'll get to methamphetamine and cocaine later, I guess.
Okay. Well, in regard to that, then, I was curious what your opinion was on it, because my point of view is that conservatives are usually more against the legalizing or decriminalizing of drugs, but I never understood how that is squared with the notion of freedom in the people. Like, how...
Well, I can tell you. I can tell you. Because here's the thing. I'm not an anarchist. So I understand that to have a society that works, you have to have rules. I'll bet your family. Right. Do you have a family?
Yes.
And I'll bet you have formal rules and some informal rules. right? So if you have a 15-year-old son and he comes in and takes his motorcycle apart in the living room and starts to work on his motorcycle, I would have liked to have done that when I was a kid, but I had to work on it out in the garage. I had a little mini bike, and I'd work on it on the garage. When I had dirt bikes, I would tear them apart, but I didn't tear them apart in the living room because there was a rule. I didn't even need to ask if there was a rule. I knew I couldn't drag that thing into the house and start taking apart a dirty, greasy motorcycle on the living room floor. So if you don't have rules like that, both spoken and unspoken, written and unwritten, your family stops working. You know, if dad decides to wash car parts in the dishwasher, mom's going to be a little upset about it, I would expect. So society has to say have the same kind of rules. When the light says green, I get to go through the intersection. If the guy who's coming through on the red decides red means go, then we're going to crash and somebody's going to die or get hurt. So the reason that we agree to rules like you can't shoot heroin, you can't sell heroin, is because they are damaging. And they're damaging in so, legalization of that drug would be so damaging to American society. Because when people go out and get high on heroin, a lot of them get addicted, maybe not all of them. And then they find themselves incapacitated to actually support themselves. So then we end up supporting them. At some point, they become so desperate for the drug that they say, I have to have the money. I'm heroin sick because I haven't had my last shot. So they go out and they steal some money from somewhere, and they may end up hurting somebody to get it. And so the downsides to that drug in particular, that and cocaine and methamphetamine, to everyone else around you. I mean, if you lived in a universe where you had an unlimited supply of heroin and you were the only person there, maybe it wouldn't have any effect. But everybody who's a heroin addict, who has kids, who has a wife or a husband, who has a job, who has responsibilities, who lives in a society, that drug is damaging to that whole society. Can we agree on that?
Well, we can agree on that, but I don't understand why feelings even matter.
It's not feeling. It's not. I didn't give you feelings. I gave you facts. If you have a heroin addict and well, it's not about feelings. You say it's about feelings. I say it's about facts. If somebody shoots heroin on a regular basis, do you think they can maintain a job?
No, I don't.
Okay, so when they don't have a job anymore, how do they get the money to buy their drugs?
They probably engage in criminal activity.
That's right, and that criminal activity hurts people around them. That isn't feelings. That is facts. That's the way it's going to go. And if that person has responsibilities, let's say that the breadwinner, whether it's the man or the woman in a family, becomes a heroin or meth addict, and they don't go to their job, who ends up supporting their family?
The government.
Which means us, the taxpayers. I mean, translated right. through right. that is coming. And let's say they have very small children who need, I mean, I have a grandbaby at home who's 15 months old. She is never out of the sight of at least one adult, and usually in the presence of several adults, because she could literally kill herself by walking out into the driveway or walking out into the street. So she has to have constant supervision. What kind of parental supervision do you think you get from a meth or a heroin addict?
Well, it's terrible, but...
Terrible. It's dead. It means you get dead kids out of it.
No, I know, but why can't the state move in and take the children? There's a protocol in place.
Hold on. How many kids do you want to be... How many kids do you want to be under state supervision, especially since...
My wants and feelings don't matter in a society...
Well, I use the word want just to facilitate the conversation. How many... Ideally, should every kid grow up without becoming a ward of the state? I'm using the
ideally?
Word, you're objecting to the word want. I'm saying, if you want me to phrase it differently, our society ideally would be a society where no child ever becomes a ward of the state, where every child has two productive, attentive parents at home who both contribute to society and pay their own bills. We don't have that, but let's shoot for that as close as possible. If we legalize or decriminalize heroin, do you think we're more likely to end up with neglected kids and dead people on the highway or in crimes?
Oh, yes, we're more likely, but if deaths on the highway are of a concern, then why don't we make driving illegal? We don't make driving illegal.
Hold, stop for a second. Could this modern society operate without vehicles?
There's a debate that would say that this modern society won't operate another 20 years because
Benjamin, don't change the subject to answer my question. I'm saying, do you go down and buy groceries for your family?
Yes.
How do you get them home?
Usually a vehicle.
Okay, and how do the groceries get to the grocery store?
In a truck.
In a vehicle, right? So when you say, why don't we illegalize vehicles? Because vehicles have a productive use in society. Does legalized heroin for recreational purposes have a productive use in society?
Or value? The heroin addict.
No, it doesn't. Because do you know any people that you look at and say, that guy, hold on. Do you know any heroin addicts where you say, that guy's been on heroin 10 years and his life is better than it's ever been before? Know anybody like that?
I don't
have any personal experience, do you think it's likely that a person who gets addicted to heroin and stays on it for years is likely to have his life get better than it was before heroin?
No, but my whole debate is not, is this a good idea? Is this a bad idea? Is this good for society?
That's what laws are all about. Laws are written to be good for society and not bad for society. Do you get that?
So the government is good.
No, I didn't say that. I didn't say that. What I said was, when you write laws, if you have a rule at your house that your son doesn't come in and take apart his motorcycle in the middle of the living room carpet, there's a rule for it because it does damage. If he does it out in the garage, it does not do damage or doesn't do as much damage. So you write the rules, and that's what legislatures and the Congress do. They write rules, we call them laws, that are designed to be good for society. Does legalizing or decriminalizing heroin do good for society?
No, but that's not the barometer for whether or not laws are passed.
Okay, then tell me, if you don't think that's the barometer, I do think it is. What do you think is the reason laws get passed?
Because people decide they want or don't want something.
Well, that's baloney. Because
how is that baloney?
It's pure baloney. They write, when they go down to the legislature in Olympia or Salem, and they say, I think it should be a law that children should not be sexually molested. The reason they write that law is because children have been sexually molested, and you make it illegal so that children won't be sexually molested. It doesn't have to do with just I want. It has to do with what is good for society. It is not good for...
No, that has everything to do with the populace not wanting children to be molested.
Well, okay, now we're just arguing semantics, because if you say, gee, we wrote...
Well, the semantics are what matter.
No, it's not what matters. People, the laws are passed by the legislature and the Congress, arguably. Now, sometimes Congress and the legislature pass crazy laws, like the cyber-stalking law, but the reason they pass laws is because the folks who write the laws generally look and say there's a problem. So, for example, somebody's flying drones over a park in Seattle, and even if a drone has never crashed and hurt anyone, there are folks who say if we're going to let drones fly over populated areas, we should probably pass some regulations to make sure that nobody, you know, puts a 20-pound drone up in the air over a public park, and then when it crashes, it hits and hurts or kills somebody. That's the impetus for writing laws. Not about want, but you can say it's about wanting not people not to be hurt, but it's about realizing that you write laws to try to do the best for the population, the family. In the case of your home, you tell your wife, it's a rule that we can't take motorcycles apart in the living room. And if your kid said, well, why not? You say, because it destroys the carpet, it makes a mess, it has to be cleaned up, it's not the appropriate place to do it, and you write a rule, whether it's spoken or written down on paper. I appreciate the call. Interesting naysayer. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the program. Glad to be with you. Don't forget, every Friday we celebrate your First Amendment freedoms with First Amendment Friday live on the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. And by the way, glad to have you on board in Spokane today, in the Tri-Cities, in Seattle, Bellingham, Portland, Medford, Klamath Falls, all over the Northwest. David Cross joins us now. Hey, David, welcome to the program. What's the latest in illegal alien developments?
Well, we've got a couple items today, Lars. The Oregon Department of Correction prison system had 981 criminal aliens in the prison system. Marion had 236 of those criminal aliens. Multnomah had 208. And Washington had 197 criminal aliens. They were more than 65% of the criminal aliens in the Oregon Department of Correction prison system from three counties. I wanted to touch on that legislation that you talked about with Josh Marquis today on reduction of the criminality of heroin possession in the state.
Yeah, decriminalization,
Yes. Did you know that legislation also reduced Class A misdemeanor from 365 days to 364 days to protect criminal aliens? According, that was what Tina Kotek said. She's the Speaker of the Oregon House of Representatives. And, you know, there were more Republicans than John Hoffman that voted for House Bill 2355. Senators DeBoer, Bill Hansel from Umatilla area, Chuck Thompson, and Jackie Winters also voted for the basically legislation to decriminalize heroin possession, plus to allow illegal aliens that committed crimes to remain in the country.
Well, check out what's going to happen now. They haven't fully complied with Real ID. Most of the heroin that comes into Oregon and Washington comes muled in by illegal aliens and Mexican drug cartels. The DEA says 90% of the heroin in the United States comes in from Mexico. So now that Oregon is decriminalized, this is going to be a booming heroin market for the Mexican drug cartels.
Absolutely, Lars. You know, of that 981 criminal aliens in the DOC prison system, 107 of them, of almost 13% are criminal aliens, and most of them are from Mexico. So this is really what I call the opium den bill. You know, it's just crazy that the Democrats and those few Republicans would vote to decriminalize heroin. And you know what? I never saw in that legislation, I read the bill, I could not find anything where they tried to monitor if there would be more drug-related deaths. You and I both know that's going to occur.
Well, I would expect that it's going to because, I mean, the argument that Josh makes, and I agree with the logic of it, is if right now you can incentivize people to go into treatment and do it before they completely crash and burn in one way or another, either physically or criminally or otherwise, and now you reduce the incentive to go into treatment to where somebody is told, well, you'll end up with a misdemeanor if we convict you, and they say, well, I'm not going into treatment for that. There's no incentive there. That if that reduces the number of people in treatment, and treatment is at least effective some percentage of the time, maybe 20%, you're going to have more addicts. You're going to have more people who overdose, and you're going to have more people who commit crimes to support their heroin habit. That's crazy. It's not good.
You know, I've never heard of a story, even in Switzerland, where they decriminalized heroin, where heroin addicts didn't try to get other individuals hooked on the drug. So I think there's going to be more drug-related deaths, more crime. And do you think that the Mexican drug cartels have more ability to control the price than the U.S. government or the state of Oregon?
Yeah, and here's the thing. If part of the price of anything is what it costs to get it to you, right? So if you're bringing potatoes from Klamath County, part of the cost of getting them is the transportation cost. Well, part of the transportation cost for heroin is the risk that people are going to get caught. So when somebody has heroin, they get caught with it. There's a cost to that. If you reduce the cost to the distributor, arguably it means the distributor can drop his price and make his product more available to more people. I just cannot understand the argument that says that more people on heroin, more heroin availability, and lower price is somehow a good thing for society.
I had a follow-up question. Lars, I read that bill, and I'm not a lawyer, and I know you're not a lawyer.
Nope.
But does that affect also heroin possession or cocaine possession and meth possession too?
No, I think it only deals with decriminalization of heroin. And I'm really anxious to talk to Jim Huffman, the Republican, and you heard why. If he's really angling to try to get a job in the Trump administration as this ag representative for the Northwest, if that's the reason that he flipped on his local prosecutors, I'm going to get his local prosecutors on from the county he's in. He promised them that he would vote the other way on this bill. He flipped for some reason, and maybe he was trying to get a job. You've got the Lars Larson Show.